This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. We're returning to the special WBAI Fund Drive show of Taking Aim. We've been off the air for a couple of weeks as we've been away, but now we're back. And today we were presenting two special premiums. Usually we present premiums that we've produced, but today we've chosen from other works on 9/11, Nanothermite by Stephen Jones, A Lecture He Gave in Sacramento, a DVD, intense lecture, very clear elucidation of the physical evidence that shows it was a controlled demolition, and specifically what was used in this controlled demolition of the World Trade Center towers. That's Nanothermite for your contribution of $50. In this hour, we're going to play excerpts from the other premium that we're offering, 9/11, The Myth and Reality, a combination of two lectures given by theologian David Ray Griffin, one at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco and another at the big Grand Lake Theater 9/11 events. This is two DVD package for $100. And WBAI is combining both of these wonderful premiums into a special two for $125 contribution to WBAI. You're a listener-sponsored station. That means it's your station. As you know, for the 8 years we've been on Taking Aim, we come to you periodically to say, get on board. Let's keep Taking Aim and other shows like ours on the air. It's only here that you're going to hear the incredible information, such as Richard Gage mentioned earlier about Nanothermite or 9/11, The Myth and Reality, David Ray Griffin. Please, 212-209-2950. Later in the show, we're going to have Frank Morales joining us. As you know, Frank is an award-winning writer discovering investigating the role of the military, the breaking of Posse Comitatus, and the development of the Northern Command, that and so much more. Frank is also one of the primary organizers of NYC CAN, which had been the ballot initiative, the proposed ballot initiative for a independent 9/11 investigation, of which Ralph was going to be one of the commissioners. Please get on board now, 212-209-2950. We're going to play brief excerpts from the David Ray Griffin, The Myth and Reality, this hour, and then we'll return briefly to the Stephen Jones Nanothermite. Ralph, I'd like to first say what the nine myths are that David Ray Griffin goes through in his lecture.
Well, David Ray Griffin addressed some of the seminal events pertaining to 9/11 that indicate and demonstrate the false flag character of this operation, what we call the inside job of 9/11. Myth number one, our political and military leaders simply would not do such a thing. Myth number two, our political and military leaders would have had no motive for orchestrating 9/11 attacks. Myth number three, such a large operation involving so many people could not have been kept a secret because someone involved in it would have talked by now. Myth number four, the 9/11 Commission, which has endorsed the official account, was an independent, impartial commission and hence can be believed. Myth number five, the Bush administration provided proof that the attacks were carried out by al-Qaeda under the direction of Osama bin Laden. Myth number six, the 9/11 attacks came as a surprise to the Bush administration. Myth number seven, U.S. officials have explained why the hijacked airliners were not intercepted. Myth number eight, official reports have explained why the Twin Towers in Building 7 of the World Trade Center collapsed. Myth number nine, there is no doubt that Flight 77 under the control of al-Qaeda hijacker Hani Hanjour struck the Pentagon. Brothers and sisters, The Myth and the Reality by David Ray Griffin deconstructs all of these official lies, the official cover story, the fabrications which represent the official fiction, if you like, about the events of 9/11. And it is a very systematic and dramatic expose that David Ray Griffin elucidates in this talk, this DVD, this important premium, which we urge you to make your own.
We're going to play an excerpt from myth number five, and then go on also, excuse me, from myth number six, and then also go on to myth number seven. We only have time for a brief excerpt. And myth number six was that the 9/11 attacks came as a surprise to the Bush administration. In other words, they could not intervene. Again, myth number six, this is from David Ray Griffin's 9/11, The Myth and the Reality. And once again, the number to call, 212-209-2950. Get on the phone now. And also get on the phone and call your friends, your family, and your colleagues and tell them to tune in and to contribute to WBAI. Take it away. Hello?
Hello, engineer. Max?
I'm afraid we're having a bit of difficulty pulling up the sound file at the moment.
Okay, Max, why don't we continue to talk.
All right, I will, as soon as it's ready.
Okay, brothers and sisters, this particular myth that we'll be playing an excerpt from addresses the claim that the Bush administration was taken by surprise with respect to the attacks of 9/11. And, of course, the huge number of prior reports of a pending attack on the Trade Center emerged in all of the major publications across the world, and included the San Francisco Chronicle and the Guardian in London and Le Monde in Paris and the Allgemeine Zeitung, the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung in Germany. But another feature, essential feature, brothers and sisters, of the evidence that the authorities were in the loop, perfectly cognizant of the attacks, indeed, of course, as we're demonstrating repeatedly, and as this very important talk by David Gray Griffin nails down, it's not just a question of prior knowledge, it's also an issue of treason at the top, the actual organization of these attacks, the responsibility and authorship of these attacks. And I'm going to mention something, brothers and sisters, which David Ray Griffin also addresses. It comes from my own talk, Myers and mine, from forging 9/11 to creating the next pandemic, a system in terminal decay. And in that particular talk, we addressed issues that David Ray Griffin advances and elucidates in this important talk of his, 9/11, The Myth and the Reality. Because you are fully cognizant of the fact, brothers and sisters, that the flu epidemic, the H1N1 flu epidemic, is a contrivance. A contrivance insofar as the swine flu itself has never infected any pigs. It's a laboratory construct. And what's important about this is that at the time of 9/11, Admiral Crow was the director of Bioport, the company that made a huge fortune on the anthrax scare. And not only did it provide a vaccine, which in fact caused enormous neurological damage to soldiers and to others, but Admiral Crow was hooked up with key investment and reassurance houses implicated in the puts and calls. And we examine Alex Brown of Bankers Trust in this regard, the firm that executed the puts and calls prior to the September 11th attacks, that took actual financial positions in the stocks of American Airlines, United Airlines, and Boeing, in the brokerage houses and reinsurance companies, including AXA Insurance, Swiss Re, and Unire. And that is the smoking gun of prior knowledge and of involvement. These trades were hubbed from Alex Brown, which acquired with Deutsche Bank acquisition of Bankers Trust. And those involved in heading the Alex Brown unit, which was Deutsche Bank's trading brokerage arm, were deeply implicated in the puts and calls. The director of enforcement of the SEC, Richard Walker, took a position as staff counsel for Deutsche Bank. And in addition to that, brothers and sisters, the career path of Enos Hartzman, the Israeli firm, is what is called the dark side of the puts venture. What we're looking at here is the notorious investment in puts and calls in the stocks of the airlines, resulting in huge amounts of money for those who undertook them. The SEC was not involved, or rather, I should say, interested in inquiring about this. Now, we have a tremendous breakdown of who's involved in the puts and calls. Israel Tech Acquisitions Corporation, Deutsche Bank, Bankers Trust, E.R. Stern, Chairman of the Board and Executive and Office Director of the company, directors, nominees, executive officers. You're talking about the central features and the characters in banking capital, the very people implicated in the huge financial crisis that we're facing. David Ray Griffin, in this important lecture, The Myth and the Reality, addresses centrally this question of the puts and calls, the prior knowledge that it manifests, and the finger that it points directly at who did 9/11. You need to have that information, brothers and sisters. It's dramatic, it's concise, it's documented, it's irrefutable. Please, get that DVD. You're contributing to Free Speech Radio, to WBAI. You're informing yourself and equipping yourselves with the necessary information to confront the lies and the mystery, so-called mystery about who did 9/11. You're part of a movement when you engage in this, when you have this information. We urge you, please, call now. Call now for 9/11, The Myth and the Reality by David Ray Griffin. We will be hopefully playing an excerpt from this.
We are ready.
Talk.
Great.
Go ahead, Max.
Max, take it away.
All right.
This is from myth number 6.
A Pentagon spokesperson, in explaining why the Pentagon was not evacuated before it was struck, claimed that the Pentagon was simply not aware that this aircraft was coming our way. The 9/11 Commission claimed that there was no warning about an unidentified aircraft heading towards Washington until 9:36, and hence only 1 or 2 minutes before the Pentagon was struck. But this claim is contradicted by Secretary of Transportation Norman Mineta's testimony about an episode that occurred in the Presidential Emergency Operations Center under the White House. In open testimony to the 9/11 Commission itself, Mineta said,
during the time that the airplane coming in to the Pentagon, there was a young man who would come in and say to the Vice President, the plane is 50 miles out, the plane is 30 miles out. And when it got down to the plane is 10 miles out, the young man also said to the Vice President, do the orders still stand? And the Vice President turned and whipped his neck around and said, of course the orders still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary?
Mineta said that this conversation occurred at 9:25 or 9:26. Hence, many minutes before the Pentagon was struck. This example gives us one of the clearest examples of the fact that the Zelikow-led 9/11 Commission cannot be trusted. Having claimed that there was no knowledge that an aircraft was approaching the Pentagon until the last minute or so, it simply omitted Mineta's testimony to the contrary. Then, to rule out the possibility that the episode Mineta had reported could have occurred, it claimed that Cheney did not even arrive down at the Presidential Emergency Operations Center until almost 10 o'clock, hence about 20 minutes after the Pentagon was struck. But this claim, besides contradicting Mineta's eyewitness testimony that Cheney was already there when Mineta arrived at 9:20, also contradicts all other reports as to when Cheney had arrived there, including a report by Cheney himself. In sum, having compared the official stories about the put options, the Secret Service, and Mineta's testimony, we can reject as a myth the idea that the attacks were unexpected. However, even if the attacks had been unexpected, should they not have been prevented? This brings us to myth number 7. U.S. officials have explained why the hijacked airliners were not intercepted. Actually, there is a sense in which this claim is true. U.S. officials have explained why the U.S. military did not prevent the attacks. The problem, however, is that they have given us 3 explanations. They are all mutually contradictory, and none of them is a satisfactory explanation. I will explain. According to standard operating procedures, if an FAA flight controller notices anything that suggests a possible hijacking, the controller is to contact a superior. If the problem cannot be fixed quickly, within about a minute, the superior is to ask NORAD, the North American Aerospace Command, to send up or scramble jet fighters to find out what is going on. NORAD then issues a scramble order to the nearest Air Force base with fighters on alert. The jet fighters at NORAD's disposal could respond very quickly. According to the U.S. Air Force website, F-15s can go from scramble order to 29,000 feet in only 2.5 minutes, after which they can fly over 1,800 miles an hour. Therefore, according to General Ralph Eberhardt, the head of NORAD, after the FAA senses that something is wrong, it takes about a minute for it to contact NORAD, after which, according to a spokesperson, NORAD can scramble fighter jets within a matter of minutes to anywhere in the United States. An Air Force traffic control document put out in 1988 warned pilots that any airplanes persisting in unusual behavior will likely find two jet fighters on their tail within 10 or so minutes. If these procedures had been carried out on the morning of 9/11, American Airlines Flight 11 and United Flight 175 would have been intercepted before they could have reached Manhattan. And American Flight 77 would have been intercepted long before it could have reached the Pentagon. Such interceptions are routine, being carried out about 100 times a year. A month after 9/11, the Calgary Herald reported that in the year 2000, NORAD has scrambled fighters 129 times. Do these scrambles often result in interceptions? Just a few days after 9/11, Major Mike Snyder, a NORAD spokesperson, told the Boston Globe that NORAD's fighters routinely intercept aircraft. Why did not such interceptions occur on 9/11? During the first few days, the public was told that no fighter jets were sent up until after the strike on the Pentagon at 9:38. However, it was also reported that signs of Flight 11's hijacking had been observed at 8:15. That would mean that although interceptions usually occur within 10 or so minutes after signs of trouble are observed, in this case, 80 or so minutes had elapsed before fighters were even airborne. This story suggested that a stand-down order had been given. Within a few days, however, a second story was put out, according to which NORAD had sent fighters up, but because notification from the FAA had been very tardy, the fighters arrived too late. On September 18th, NORAD made this second story official, embodying it in a timeline which indicated when NORAD had been notified by the FAA about each airplane and when it had scrambled fighters in response. Critics quickly showed, however, that even if the FAA notifications had come as late as NORAD's timeline indicated, NORAD's jets would have had time to make interceptions. The second story did not, therefore, remove the suspicion that a stand-down order had been given. Hoping to overcome this problem, the 9/11 Commission report provided a third account, according to which, contrary to NORAD's timeline of September 18th, the FAA did not notify NORAD about Flight 175 until after it had struck the South Tower, or about Flight 77 until after it had struck the Pentagon. But there are three big problems with this third story. One problem is the very fact that it is the third story. Normally, when a suspect in a criminal investigation keeps changing his story, we get suspicious. Let's say that the police asked Charlie Jones where he was on the night of a particular crime. He says he was at the movie theater, but they say, no, the movie theater has been closed all week. Oh, Charlie says, that's right, I was with my girlfriend. No, the police say, we checked with her and she was home with her husband. At that point, Charlie says, oh, now I remember, I was home reading the Bible. You're probably not going to believe Charlie. And yet that's what we have here. The military told one story right after 9/11, another story a week later, and a third through the 9/11 Commission report in 2004. The second problem with this third story is that it contradicts several features of the second story, which had served as the official story for almost 3 years. For example, NORAD's timeline had indicated...
Max, are we back?
Yes, we are. We are back on, and I have Frank. I will put him through.
Terrific. Frank?
Hi, Frank.
Well, we're trying to get through.
Hello.
Hi, Frank.
How are you?
Good. How are you guys?
We're good.
We've just played an excerpt of the David Ray Griffin 9/11, The Myth and the Reality. We played little excerpts from Myth 6, and we're now on Myth 7. Myth 6 is that the 9/11 attacks came as a surprise to the Bush administration, and Myth 7, that U.S. officials have explained why the hijacked airliners were not intercepted, in other words, the stand down. And now we'd like people to call 212-209-2950. Step up to the plate. Let's keep WBAI on the air 24/7, bringing us programs like Taking Aim, bringing us all the programs that you rely upon day in and day out. Ralph?
Hey, brothers and sisters, what you just heard from David Ray Griffin was a citation of the actual official testimony by the Secretary of Transportation, Norman Mineta. And this testimony by Norman Mineta, which is videotaped and is in this very DVD that you will be receiving, shows Mineta stating officially that Cheney was in the Pentagon as the plane was approaching it. And he quotes Cheney as being told by, quote, a young man who said to the vice president, "The plane is now 50 miles out. The plane is now 30 miles out." And when it got down to, quote, "The plane is 10 miles out," Mineta states, the young man said to the vice president, "Do the orders still stand?" And Cheney said, "Of course the orders still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary?" Now, this is an official stating that the vice president of the United States was monitoring the approaching plane and giving stand-down orders not to intercept that plane.
This is the Secretary of Transportation.
Secretary of Transportation.
A member of the cabinet.
So, brothers and sisters, you get the message here. This documentation and this lecture and this extraordinary expose of the myths pertaining to 9/11 that is so synthesized in this DVD by David Ray Griffin puts the nail in the coffin of the official fiction that 9/11 is an event caused by putative terrorists from the outside. This is the inside job. This is terrorizing the people of the United States. You've got to have this information, brothers and sisters. Please support Free Speech Radio, support Taking Aim, and above all, support yourselves in being in possession of the dramatic evidence documented and expounded upon by David Ray Griffin. Please call in and get this DVD, get the premium, support this work.
212-209-2950. Now, Frank, what David Ray Griffin discusses and what he's elaborated in various books is the debunking of the official 9/11 commission report presented by Congress, supervised by Philip Zelikow, who was a protege of Condoleezza Rice and worked with her very closely, and eliminated this Norman Mineta testimony from the official commission report. So you have been one of the originators and important figures in trying to have a ballot initiative in New York to have an independent investigation. Could you tell us something about it and why it is so important to have independent spokespeople such as we have with WBAI?
And where we stand right now, Frank, with the, you know, let me just say this. Frank and his comrades succeeded in obtaining over 45,000 signatures, more than the requisite number to have been entitled to have this commission established. And, of course, the authorities stepped in under one pretext or another to block it. Where are we now, Frank?
Well, greetings, everyone. First of all, I'd strongly, you know, encourage people to pledge to the station and support BAI, support Free Speech Radio, and also to go out tomorrow and get everything you can regarding David Ray Griffin's work, both his DVDs on the subject of 9/11 as well as his books. He's an eminently responsible and readable and clear-headed thinker. As you know, he's a theologian. He's written over 30 books in the area of process theology and so forth. He leaves no stone unturned when it comes to looking at this case, and I think you'll come away the way most people do, somewhere within a continuum of feeling very strongly that there needs to be a new investigation, or you may, like a large and growing number of people, need no more convincing and be convinced that, in fact, elements of our government, within the military establishment, within the intelligence community, actively participated in state-sponsored terrorism against the American people, against the people of the world, in order to justify their land grab in Afghanistan, in Iraq, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the same old story. You decide. I'm not here to preach one perspective or another, but suffice to say, if you look at David's material and Professor Jones and Richard Gage, et cetera, et cetera, you're going to come away wanting to have a lot of questions answered. Now, here in New York, a couple of years back, there was an effort begun to establish a means by which we could actually effectuate an authentic investigation of 9/11. Because, as you know, the 9/11 Commission was a whitewash. Philip Zelikow, confidant of Condoleezza Rice, controlled the operation pretty much. They dictated what would be looked at, what wouldn't be looked at, what would be deep sixed, and so on. And we haven't had a real investigation. People, you know, said to us, well, why do you want to have an investigation here in New York? And the simple answer, the short answer, is that we haven't had one. There has been no law enforcement entity in this country that has looked at the crime of 9/11. Now, that may sound shocking, but it's true. The 9/11 Commission issued two subpoenas in the entire case, refused, as we know, to interview the key people, and so on. So it was a sham, to say the least. Even the people who directed it claimed that it was set up to fail. The long story short here in New York is that through the efforts of NYCCAN, NYCCAN.org, you can go check out their site, under the able leadership of people like Tim Walter and other people who were involved in this campaign for many, many years, including Les Jamison and the early period and so on, worked, you know, just what has been done by this relatively small group, coupled with the fact that 80,000 residents of New York City signed a petition, 80,000 signed a petition calling simply for a new investigation, for an investigation here in New York City to be conducted by a commission and so forth with subpoena power. And so on. The 80,000 signatures and petitions were validated, 45,000, or the requisite number, more to the point, the requisite number was accepted by the various city clerk's office and so forth. The courts then took over, and as usually is the case here, if you don't, you play by the rules as best you can, but then you get into a court situation, and for various reasons, the court deemed that this is not in the jurisdiction, this is a federal case, et cetera, et cetera. The usual stuff, they shut us down. So once again, the voice of New York, as some of those BAI listeners remember when the issue of nuclear weapons stationed out in Staten Island was in a similar kind of referendum. The massive voter turnout in opposition to this, it didn't matter. It was a national security issue. They were going to do it. We are not going to see any kind of justice through this approach, apparently. The courts turned us down. We had thought in terms of potentially moving ahead on another level of appeal, but it doesn't. It seems less than possible that we would see any real justice there. So, long story short, we are taking a deep breath. We are recalibrating our strategy and have issued a document which people can access on the nyccan.org website called The Turning Point, which, to summarize very, very briefly, because you can read it yourselves and see where things are headed, we have decided that we're going to move in a number of directions. One is to agitate and educate and inspire people around the country to do similar kinds of create various kinds of investigative efforts in their own communities, whether through referendum, through district attorneys, through popular means, democratic processes, to bring about a real investigation on the grassroots level across the country. NICAN, if it's done anything, is to show that the people are aware, they're educated, and they're capable of mounting these kinds of efforts. So we're encouraging that around the country. We didn't invent the wheel, and we don't suspect that the end of that road is upon us. There's lots of possibilities in that area around the country, including a civil case, which there are people here in New York that are considering moving in that direction as well. We may hear more about that in the near future. Another area that we're looking at is to mount a public relations campaign, a sophisticated public relations campaign, to deepen the base of those who are aware and educated. For instance, what Ralph and Maya have been doing today with you, alongside of raising money for the station, is to educate, put out materials that educate us to exactly what has, 9/11 represents, which is a gigantic fraud perpetrated upon the American people, an unsolved murder of thousands and thousands of people, and the ramifications of which we're still feeling with the bloodletting that's going on in different parts of the world. So one of the things that we have sought to put together at this point is to gather up those military and intelligence professionals who are exceptions within the Pentagon structure. As we know, an apparatus of gross pathology currently involved in doing the bidding of the oil companies and the banks and so on throughout parts of the world. Those elements within these communities who have stepped apart from that and are speaking out, not only in terms of what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan, but who are speaking out on 9/11. Patriots on 9/11 truth sites and other sites now feature growing numbers of military and intelligence people who have stepped forward to distance themselves, to put it mildly, from the official story of 9/11. Those individuals now will be put out front and center in a sophisticated public relations effort throughout the country. And will be made available to people, will be speaking to people, will be the subject of various ad spots and so forth, coming out and making plain that the official story of 9/11 is simply untenable. So that's
Thanks. We need to remind people, 212-209-2950. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. And the reason you can listen to WBAI and hear from Frank and hear from Ralph and hear from myself is because of your contributions to WBAI. 212-209-2950. We have chosen two gifts for you. 9/11, The Myth and Reality, the seminal lectures by David Ray Griffin at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco and also at the Grand Lake Theater. It includes many special features. And also Nanothermite, an amazing lecture by Stephen Jones, a longtime physicist, professor for 20 years at Brigham Young University. He really knows how to explain things so that each and every one of us can understand how the bringing down of the World Trade Center buildings 1, 2, and 7, which was not hit by an airplane, were controlled demolitions, and what Stephen Jones and other scientists have discovered is what was the chemical that did it, nanothermite, and they explain why. $50 for nanothermite, $100 for 9/11, The Myth and the Reality. Please get on the phone, and if you have both of these DVD sets, there are two in the David Ray Griffin, one for the Stephen Jones. For the three DVDs, it would be $125 contribution. 212-209-2950. For 8 years, we have been demystifying, analyzing, presenting meticulous documentation, not just about 9/11, but about the geopolitics of this world and what it means to each and every one of us, whether it is the pandemics and how they are created, whether it is about the collapse of the financial markets and the role of the ruling class in having this happen. happen. This is what we have done from the beginning. If you remember, in the short days after 9/11, it was WBAI that put Ralph Schoenman on the air. 5 hours, five fluid hour presentation of World Trade Center, the uncensored history, which laid out the politics, the reason why 9/11 happened as a false flag operation, the reason that the military powers were eager to get into Iraq and Afghanistan. What we see unfolding, this was WBAI. You didn't hear it anywhere else. It was WBAI that presented Ralph Schoenman in those five historic hours of World Trade Center Uncensored History, and has kept taking AIM on the air for 8 years. We've been coming to you 8 years now, and it's only here on WBAI that you hear the voice of Frank Morales, that you hear Richard Gage, that you hear David Ray Griffin, Stephen Jones, that you hear all this day in and day out. Where would you be with WBAI silenced? And as I said, this is our gift to you. This isn't a purchase. This is a gift. This is a presentation of a gift to you in recognition of your contribution, of you maintaining your station, WBAI. 212-209-2950. The reason we're talking about 9/11 is this is current events. As the escalation of the war happens in Afghanistan, as wars are precipitated in Pakistan, as so much is happening in the United States to destroy the very fabric of life for each and every one of us, we must go back to the official fictions. And that's why we particularly chose to discuss 9/11. And these are two lectures that are done in very simple terms that each and every one of you can understand, and not just understand, that you can come away and make the presentation yourself to your friends and your colleagues and your family. 9/11, The Myth and Reality, $100 2-DVD presentation by David Ray Griffin, and Nanothermite by Stephen Jones. And what I'd like you to do, if you are able to do so, is to pledge the $125, and we are going to send you this package of both of these important DVDs. 212-209-2950. Ralph?
Well, my David Ray Griffin in this important talk describes and discusses the role of the central financial institutions and of those in authority in implementing what are called the puts and calls, the prior knowledge in which huge fortunes were made predicated upon the collapse of the value of specific stocks. And the puts and calls were not just a question of the mysterious who. This is what David Ray Griffin, amongst others, has documented. Breakdown, Israel Tech Acquisition Corporation, Deutsche Bank, the Carlyle Group, executive officers, directors and nominees, E.R. Stern, chairman of the board and executive officer and director of the company, co-chief executive and president of the company, Helix Management Company, Helix Capital, Helix Mergers and Acquisitions, WordStar International, Business Development, Elron Electronics, Random Access. This is not a matter of speculation, brothers and sisters, and this important talk by David Ray Griffin includes documentation about the authorship of the puts and calls, which, in fact, is the predicate for understanding the role of authority and of the banksters in particular in orchestrating and engineering the events of 9/11. Avail yourself of this important DVD. Support WBAI. Support Free Speech Radio. Support NYC CAN and the efforts of Frank Morales, William Pepper, Les Jameson, ourselves, in attempting to bring to a wide public a thorough investigation with all of this important data assembled in an arena which will go around the world. Please support this work, support the station, call in for this DVD.
Frank, we're going to return to our conversation with you in a moment, but I think we should also now return to another segment from 9/11, The Myth and the Reality. Max, do you have it queued up?
It's ready to go.
Okay.
With four callers on the line.
Well, we need many more. Four callers, thank you. It's a beginning. We can have, we have Max there. We have people in the pledge room. Please, let's get all those lines ringing. These are very important. We're here in California, and thanks to our engineer, Michael Yoshida, at KPFA, and thanks to Kathy Davis, and thanks to Michael G. Haskins, and all the people, and thanks to Max, we are able to come to you each and every week. Please, now, let's get on the line, 212-209-2950, and you can telephone at the same time that this is playing, because it's going to be in your possession very soon. Max, take it away.
For example, NORAD's timeline had indicated that the FAA had notified it about Flight 175 20 minutes before the South Tower was struck, and notified it about Flight 77 at least 14 minutes before the Pentagon was struck. The 9/11 Commission maintains that both of these statements were incorrect, that really there had been no notification that about these flights until after they hit their targets. This is why the military failed to intercept them. But if NORAD's timeline was false, as the Commission now claims, NORAD must have been either lying or confused. But it is hard to believe that it could have been confused 1 week after 9/11. So it must have been lying. But if NORAD was lying then, why should we believe them now? Further skepticism about this third story arises from the fact that it is contradicted by considerable evidence. For example, the Commission's claim that the military did not know about Flight 175 until it reached its goal is contradicted by a report by Captain Michael Jelinek, who on 9/11 was overseeing NORAD's headquarters in Colorado. According to a story in the Toronto Star, Jelinek is a Canadian, Jelinek was on the phone with NORAD as he watched Flight 175 crash into the South Tower. He then asked NORAD, "Was that the hijacked aircraft you were dealing with?" To which NORAD said, "Yes." The 9/11 Commission's claims about Flight 175 and 77 are also contradicted by a memo sent to the Commission by Laura Brown of the FAA. Her memo stated that the FAA had set up a teleconference at about 8:50 that morning, at which time it started sharing information about all flights with the military. She specifically mentioned Flight 77. Her memo, which is available on the web, was discussed by the Commission and read into its record on May 23, 2003. But Zelikow's 9/11 Commission report fails to mention this memo. Because of these and still more problems, which I have discussed in a lecture called Flights of Fancy, this third story does not remove the grounds for suspicion that a stand-down order had been given. There is, moreover, ear witness testimony for this suspicion. An upper management official at LAX, who needs to remain anonymous, told me that he overheard members of LAX security, including officers from the FBI and the LAPD, interacting on their walkie-talkies shortly after the attacks. In some cases, he could hear both sides of the conversation. At first, the LAX officials were furious because they were told that the airplanes that attacked the World Trade Center and the Pentagon had not been intercepted because the FAA had not notified NORAD about the hijackings. But later, he reports, they were even more furious because they were told that NORAD had been notified but did not respond because it had been ordered to stand down. When LAX security officials asked who had issued that order, they were told that it came from the highest level of the White House. That, of course, would mean Cheney. Accordingly, the idea that the attacks could not have been prevented is a myth. To move to myth number 8, official reports have explained why the Twin Towers and Building 7 of the World Trade Center collapsed. This claim suffers from the same problem as the previous one. We have had 3 explanations, each of which contradicts the others, and none of which is anywhere near adequate. The first explanation widely disseminated through television specials, was that the buildings collapsed because their steel columns were melted by the jet fuel-fed fires. But this explanation contained many problems, the most obvious of which is that steel does not begin to melt until about 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit, while open fires based on hydrocarbons such as kerosene, which is what jet fuel is, cannot, even under the most ideal circumstances, rise above 1,700 degrees. A second explanation, endorsed by the 9/11 Commission report, is a pancake theory, according to which the fires, while not melting the steel, heated it up sufficiently to cause the floors weakened by the airplane strikes to break loose from the steel columns, both those in the core and those around the outside. All the floors above the strike zone hence fell down on the floor below the strike zone, causing it to break free, and this started a chain reaction so that the floors pancaked all the way down. But this explanation also suffered from many problems, the most obvious of which was that it could not explain why the buildings collapsed into a pile of rubble only a few stories high. The core of each of the twin towers consisted of 47 massive steel columns. If the floors had broken loose from them, these columns would have still been sticking up into the air 1,000 feet. The 9/11 Commission report tried to cover up this problem by claiming that the core of each tower consisted of a hollow steel shaft. But those massive steel columns could not be wished away. The definitive explanation was supposed to be a third one, issued by the National Institute for Standards and Technology, usually called NIST. The NIST report claimed that when the floors collapsed, they, rather than breaking free from the columns, pulled on them, causing the perimeter columns to become unstable. This instability then increased the gravity load on the core columns, which had been weakened by tremendously hot fires in the core, which NIST claims reached over 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit. And this combination of factors resulted in global collapse. But as physicists Jim Hoffman and Stephen Jones have shown, this account is riddled with problems. One of these is that NIST's claim about the tremendously hot fires in the core is completely unsupported by the evidence or logic. A second problem is that even if this sequence of events had occurred, NIST provided no explanation as to why it would have produced global, that is, total, collapse. The NIST report asserts that column failure occurred in the core as well as the perimeter columns, but this remains a bare assertion. There is no plausible explanation of why the core columns would have broken or even buckled so as to produce global collapse. And this is only to begin to enumerate the problems in this theory, all of which follow from the fact that it, like the previous two theories, is essentially a fire theory, according to which the buildings were brought down primarily by fire. In the case of the Twin Towers, of course, the impact of the airplanes is said to have played a role. But most experts who support the official theory attribute the collapses primarily to the fire. NIST, for example, says that the main contribution of the airplanes, aside from providing jet fuel, was to dislodge a lot of the fireproofing from the steel, thereby making it vulnerable to the fires. By the way, when you go home tonight and light your fire in your fireplace, be sure to fireproof your steel, or the grate may collapse. But these fire theories face several formidable problems. First, the fires in these three buildings were not very hot, very big, or very long-lasting, compared with fires in some steel frame high-rises that did not collapse. A 1991 fire in Philadelphia burned 18 hours, and a 2004 fire in Caracas burned 17 hours without causing even a partial collapse. By contrast, the fires in the North and South Towers burned only 102 and 56 minutes, respectively, before they collapsed. And neither fire, unlike the Philadelphia and Caracas fires, were hot enough to break windows. Second, total collapses of steel frame high-rise buildings have never, either before or after 9/11, been brought about by fire alone or fire plus externally caused structural damage. The collapse of Building 7 has been recognized as especially difficult to explain. It was not hit by a plane, so the explanation has to rely solely on fire. And yet, because there was no jet fuel to get a big fire started, this building had fires on only two or three floors, according to several witnesses and all photographic evidence. FEMA admitted that the best theory...
Well, you're back. We're back. What? This is Maya Schoen and
Ralph Schoen.
Taking Aim, and we're back for the WBAI Fund Drive. You've been listening to an excerpt of 9/11, The Myth and the Reality, David Ray Griffin. Hello, Max?
Yes.
Yes, 212-209-2950. How many people are on the line?
Well, all of the calls that we had earlier, we had five, but they are all gone, meaning that there's room for anyone to call and get through right now.
Okay, 212-209-2950. Please get on the line. 9/11, The Myth and the Reality, David Ray Griffin, $100 contribution, two DVDs. We also have Nanothermite. We're going to hear excerpts from it in the next hour, and we're going to bring on Greg Roberts, one of the authors of a very important report on nanothermite as the explosive element that brought down the World Trade Center buildings. And now we have with us Frank Morales of NYC CAN, and Frank is also one of the most important researchers in the country about Posse Comitatus, and about the development of the Northern Command. He has exposed so much about the role of the military here in the United States. Frank.
Mm-hmm.
You're still with us.
Yeah,
great.
Of course.
So, Frank, let's discuss a little bit more about what people can do, and in particularly how they can contribute to WBAI.
Well, obviously the mainstream media, and even a sizable chunk of the quote-unquote left media, I'd say that, a bit tongue-in-cheek, but maybe not so much so, has seen fit not to cover some of the kinds of things that Taking Aim has covered, relentlessly and in depth over the past 8 years, which is that the official story of 9/11, and the myth, as David Ray Griffin refers to it, of 9/11, is a pack of lies, essentially, is full of contradictions and misinformation and omissions and distortions and so forth and so on. The importance of radio stations like BAI in terms of communicating the truth of at least, raising questions. We don't want to sound overly presumptuous that we have it all sort of sewn up, but there certainly is, over a period of time, since 9/11 occurred, have looked at this. You're bringing forth this evening a physicist, a theologian, and an architect. And we can bring forth hundreds of other, like-minded individuals who come from various walks of life who've raised in-depth questions about any number of aspects to the case of 9/11. The point of entry into critiquing the so-called official story there are myriad points of entry into this case, whether it's the puts and the options, whether it's who are the hijackers, the way in which these towers collapsed, the funding stream of this whole thing, the stand-down orders of the military, what exactly occurred in terms of the so-called phone calls that were coming from these flights, and so on and so forth. There's just so much to look at. And over the course of 8 years, citizens across this country and the world have taken it upon themselves to examine these questions and use some critical thinking and use their intelligence and deconstructed this story. And, I don't see any way that one can avoid looking at the truth of the assertion that the official story of 9/11 is a fraud, other than sticking your head in the sand. David R. Griffin, for instance, in a later speech, takes that myth, the idea of 9/11, the myth of 9/11, which is equated in his talk with the official story as a myth, and uses that as a way of describing why it is that people, otherwise rational people, refuse to even look at evidence which would contradict the official story. Take, for example, the materials you're offering tonight. David Ray Griffin spoke at our venues here in New York City numbers of years ago. In fact, some of his DVDs are actually shot in venues that we helped to set up here in New York early on. I've routinely offered these DVDs to people over the course of many years, and very often, maybe not that often, but more than you'd like, people just hold up their hand and it's kind of like, I don't want to see that. They refuse to look at it. Long story short, David Ray Griffin's talk on the truth of 9/11 and this whole idea of this misplaced patriotism, this almost religious faith in the official story, he's taken the myth of 9/11 and the official story and taken it one step further to say, look, this myth has become tantamount to a religious myth, that the lie of 9/11 has taken on this sanctimonious kind of aspect where people refuse to even look at it because it's kind of heretical, and that it strikes deep within the consciousness that where religious myths are formed. It's a very sophisticated analysis as to why otherwise rational people refuse to look at it. But in any case, the media, as you know, has refused to look at this material. Nobody's, why is the issue of military-grade thermite having been discovered by a number of physicists and put forward in peer-reviewed journals and so forth? Why isn't that news?
It is news on WBAI, and that's why. That's why everyone must get on the phone right now.
You're not going to get anywhere else, people. You have to keep these lines of communication open, or we're simply not going to get this kind of information, let alone to get the kind of information that Taking Aim on WBAI offers around 9/11. And this gets a little more specific. I've been involved in the so-called 9/11 truth movement and been aware of it for a number of years now and looked at a lot of materials. And those who are familiar with this movement, quote-unquote, are aware of the diversity of ideological opinions and stances. And it's a very diverse movement, and that has its value. The sleuthing that has gone on, and that some of which, a good part of extremely well-documented information and so forth that's out there, and it's very, very credible. The stuff that Gage and Dr. Griffin and Steve Jones and others have put out is extremely credible. I strongly suggest that people look at it. But nonetheless, the movement as a whole, I think, has suffered in some degree to a lack of specificity in terms of its politics, in terms of its situating the crime of 9/11 within the overall context of a capitalist system that is hell-bent on destruction, that is hell-bent on, is just full of greed and is orchestrating wars abroad and wars at home against its own people, and answering the question, well, why did 9/11 take place within the context of the capitalist system and what it signifies and so forth? That is rare within the overall 9/11 truth movement. I think that we need to look at this as a movement in the future, and we've had some discussions on this, in situating the truth of 9/11 within creating openings for the peace movement. Because the people who are out there struggling mightily to prevent the further carnage in Afghanistan and Iraq and so forth need to become identified with these efforts around 9/11 truth. The truth of 9/11 implies the ability for this, for our people, to undo the havoc that the Pentagon Incorporated is creating around this world.
And Frank, that's where we get to the contribution to WBAI.
And this is,
as you know, that's where Taking Aim comes in.
This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org, on the World Wide Web at 8 o'clock. We have some people to thank, if you'd like to have some...
Yes, we would, Max.
With the tally for the first hour, 2765. almost $3,000, and we still have one caller on the line, so could make $3,000 for the first hour. 212-209-2950. We thank Philip Cologne, as well as Dennis McMahon, who has pledged. And all the rest are anonymous, but Susan, thank you, in Brooklyn, and Janine in Brooklyn, and Gabriel in Ridgewood, and Nicola, also in Brooklyn. A lot of folks listening in Brooklyn this evening.
Well, that's terrific. And if you're listening on the World Wide Web through WBAI.org, now is the time to make a telephone call, 212-209-2950. We have many people who listen to Taking AIM via the radio stream and also via our archive. And our archive wouldn't exist were it not for WBAI. 8 years of programming, Taking AIM, many shows about 9/11, about the capitalist economy, about the political incursions, imperialism throughout the world. Please get on the phone, 212-209-2950, David Ray Griffin, 9/11, The Myth and the Reality, your $100 contribution, $50, Nanothermite, Stephen Jones, and we're going to bring on in the next hour Greg Roberts, one of the authors with Stephen Jones of the important article, the Peer Journal article on nanothermite, detailing their investigation. But this DVD is a layman's guide to the issue, and you'll come away understanding, incredible understanding of what brought down those World Trade Center towers and how this could only have been done inside, as an inside job of the Department of Defense, Department of Energy. This is where the security apparatus of the United States comes in, just what Frank's been talking about. 212-209-2950. Please get on the phone right now. Ralph.
What Frank was describing, brothers and sisters, is the character of the system that generates a 9/11, the treason at the top, the 1% of the population that owns and controls more than 95% of the rest of us combined. Brothers and sisters, in 1978, a comprehensive study of the Brookings Institute detailed the frequency of U.S. invasions between 1946 and 1975. In Force Without War, U.S. Armed Forces is a political instrument. The study prepared for the Defense Department's Advanced Research Project exposed that there were 215 times between 1946 and 1975 in which United States Armed Forces were used for specific political objectives. Invading countries, overthrowing their rulers, suppressing national movements, U.S. armed forces were utilized on an average of 7.2 times a year between 1946 and 1975. And this is the conclusion of this study in 78, brothers and sisters. As the Vietnam War fades from the nation's consciousness, voices urging a more active military role of the U.S. are heard, particularly as the international system presents a huge number of opportunities, quote-unquote. And in 1979, Lawrence Mosher for the Pentagon formulated a plan which he said, quote, is circulating in Washington corridors. Here's what it said. What military people call the U.S. 100,000-man quick strike force consisting of three divisions, rapidly deployable anywhere, is prepared to act now. As one defense official said, we need a real boogeyman to come in and have to be stopped. Before we can talk to the public of using our quick strike force, it may turn out that boogeyman does not define the same way in Arabic as it does in English. This is January 19, 1979. Brothers and sisters, on August 25, 1977, President Jimmy Carter issued a secret presidential directive, PD-18, calling for the preparation of strike forces of many divisions capable of rapid intervention in the Middle East and in the oil-producing areas of the Gulf and the surrounding region. We need a boogeyman to come in and have to be stopped before we can talk of using this quick strike force, brothers and sisters. This is the predicate for the 9/11. This is the predicate for the attack of 1993. This is the formulation of imperialism and of its military instruments and of every administration, notably Democratic and Republican. 9/11, like 1993, is the fruit of a ruling class in a system in terminal decay. What Frank was articulating just now is precisely the context in which the massive evidence that is adduced and synthesized by David B. Griffin is placed in its correct and necessary political understanding. The way forward, brothers and sisters, is to deploy the evidence for a movement of the many. Please avail yourself of this important data. Equip yourselves, brothers and sisters, for the struggles ahead. Support free speech. Support taking aim. Support WBAI. Support yourselves with the information that arms us for political struggle, because this is a struggle for the survival of our country, for the survival of working people across frontiers, across the world.
212-209-2950. I heard one person call. Now we need many more of you to fill the line. Before we continue with our discussion, we're going to play excerpts, continue excerpts from Nanothermite. And what you're going to hear from the Nanothermite, you cannot see. You have to have the DVD to see the amazing video and photographic analysis. It really puts it together, and you'll have a deep understanding. You will come away with clear-minded, set with an understanding of how this was a controlled demolition and what was the explosive agent. And it's so methodical, but you must get on the line, 212-209-2950. You can't see the fullness of this on the Internet. You must have the DVD. There are sections that do not appear. 212-209-2950. As well, this is your opportunity to contribute to WBAI. Every week, we come on the air thanks to you. We broadcast throughout the world. We're heard in about 77 countries through people taking down shows from our website and from the WBAI stream. People in China, people in New Zealand, people in Australia, people in Europe, people in Latin America. This is a result of the WBAI connection. Also, people within the prisons listen to us. They rely upon the information that we present each week, and that's only because of your generous contribution. Your generous contribution that makes you a member. You are part of the WBAI community. Let's get going. Let's keep it together. Let's affect the change in the world. This is not a spectator sport. We say that over and again. The analysis and the research, the meticulous research that we do, combing all the newspapers, combing reports, it's not enough of presenting data. Has to do with how you put it together. And what is the result? The result is not electing another Democratic Party official. The result is true social change, developing parties of our own, developing a system in which each and every one of us has a quality of life that we deserve. Please, WBAI, as a media outlet, is one of the rare media outlets, the voice, gives voice to us as the Internet cannot. WBAI reaches each and every one of us, whether they're in their car, whether they're listening on the radio. Anyone can tune in, and anyone can tune in across the world. Please, 212-209-2950.
Six callers on the line right now. Room for more. Six.
Six callers. Great. We still have room for more. We have volunteers in the WBAI studios. Thanks to each and every one of you who are calling. As I said, these are our gifts to you. We selected from the many premiums that WBAI is offering this time things that we thought that we like. And we know, as the Taking Aim listeners, that you are going to appreciate. Most of the time, we offer premiums that we produce ourselves. This time, we are expanding our range, and we are offering lectures that we appreciate listening to. And that's David Ray Griffin's 9/11, The Myth and the Reality, and above all, again, something you're not going to hear anywhere else, and that's Stephen Jones' Nanothermite Lecture. I was blown away by the documentation. I have to say that because he made it so clear and so understanding. in the way that Richard Feynman did for physics for me. And what Stephen Jones does is he goes step by step in his quiet way through all the research and tells you exactly why this is what happened. Please, we're going to hear an excerpt, and we've heard the excerpt of David Ray Griffin. Now is the time to get on the phone. We don't want to play more until we have all those lines filled. 212-209-2950.
And Frank,
yes,
please talk a bit more about where we're going with this and how this movement is building and why this data that is being presented is central to the task of reaching the many.
Well, I think it's very important to understand that 9/11 was a military operation in behest of the Pentagon Incorporated. And that once people understand that, it's not only about military operations abroad, but the military operations abroad imply military operations at home. It's a dialectic between what happens around the world and what's happening here on the so-called home front. We're endangered by the current circumstances, and it's very important that people get the information that they can only get at places like WBAI in order to be better equipped to orchestrate a fight back on this whole issue of militarism at abroad. So I strongly encourage, I'm going to sign off and let some other people get on. I know he's got some other guests. I strongly encourage people to support the station, to support the work that Ralph and Maya are doing. It's all of us together. There's no way this is going to happen unless we all pool our resources and make it happen. I can only suggest to you that the materials that they're offering to you, Richard Gage and David Ray Griffin and Stephen Jones and so forth, is first rate. We're not talking about sloganeering here. We're talking about articulate, intellectual, professional people who are laying out some very, very important truths that people need to get a hold of, if not for yourselves, for those who are yet to come. We need to stop the bloodletting around this world. We need to put an end to it. And the truth of 9/11 implies our ability to potentially undo this evil that we're all confronting. So good luck, and keep up the good fight, and I hope to see you all soon.
Thanks, Frank.
Thank you as always, Frank.
Again, 212-209-2950. We're now going to play an excerpt from Nanothermites, and then we're going to bring on, oops, there go our dogs. We're now going to bring on Greg Roberts, one of the authors with Stephen Jones of the incredible research. So please get on the phone. This is the last opportunity. This is the only time during the WBAI Fund Drive that we're offering these premiums, Nanothermite, 9/11, the myth and reality. And, Max, do we have an excerpt from Nanothermite queued up?
We do indeed.
Great. Let's go to it, and then please call Greg Roberts. Thanks.
De Rouge. De La Couche Rouge, okay, the red side. Carbon, oxygen, aluminum, silicon, and iron, just as we observed. So these results confirm our published results. And I know that Mark is preparing his paper for publication in an established scientific journal. And I hope Dr. Henri Coignier will do the same. Now, as you'll read in our paper, which I hope you will read, let me ask for applause. How many have actually read at least part of this paper? Okay, that's good, but it's obviously not all. So I'd encourage you to read it. It's not hard to find. If you Google, for instance, Herit, Open Chemical Physics Journal, I should pull it right up for you. Red Gray Chips is a good way to Google for this too. So I soaked some chips in paint solvent working with Dr. Fair. We found, this is one of the early tests we did, the chip does not dissolve. Now, paint, which we also soaked in, I bought the solvent, it's methyl ethyl ketone, purchased it at a hardware store, it's a paint solvent. So I put chips of paint in there and they dissolved certainly the paint got flimsy, and then you see dissolving, dissolution. But these chips did not dissolve at all. And there's no zinc, and now this, you know, is not, it's just not paint. Instead, what you see in these photographs is that the red portion swelled. The gray-black portion did not seem to be affected by the solvent at all. The red portion swelled. And can you see the in the right photo the porosity that's now evident in the chip, the red material? And perhaps you can notice that there's some red material, which, and then with pores, this is primarily silicon dioxide, silica, with some iron oxide mixed in. And then in the left-hand side of this photo, the right photo, you see a silvery region. We found that the aluminum, elemental aluminum, separated out with under the action of this paint solvent. Very interesting. Remember, there's a lot of carbon in here. The carbon does seem to break down. Okay, let's look at the data. Getting ahead of myself. This is in the paper. After the MEK soak, we now see regions where we see aluminum separated from silicon and oxygen. So if you look at the leftmost plot, you see a region, you see the silicon and oxygen, a little bit of iron, essentially no aluminum. This is not aluminum silicate. It's not kaolinite, as some debunker said. Oh, the kaolinite, that's all it is. No. You can't use a paint solvent and separate the aluminum from the silicon oxide in an aluminosilicate. It's just a solvent. It's not a reducing agent, okay? So, and now if you look at the middle plot, you see a large peak of aluminum, very little silicon. Again, this is not an aluminosilicate because the aluminum has now increased dramatically, just has been pulled out of this matrix of stuff in the red material. The oxygen is much less than the aluminum, and we deduced, Dr. Fair is an expert in this machine, that the aluminum content exceeds the oxygen content significantly, and so there must be at least some elemental aluminum, which is one of the prime ingredients of thermite. There is also iron oxide, as shown in the rightmost plot. Oxygen and iron here, the oxygen in each case was sufficient to completely oxidize the iron, unlike the aluminum, where the oxygen was insufficient to oxidize all of the aluminum. See the difference? So elemental aluminum had to be present. Some of it, at least, was element. You know, you have little bits of aluminum, little particles of aluminum. You get an oxide layer that forms very rapidly. It's called the passivation, and that occurs on the surface and actually protects the interior aluminum from being further oxidized. Sorry, science. And to me, this is exciting. You look at that and you say, whoa, whoa, there's aluminum in there, elemental aluminum. It's not aluminosilicate because the silicon's separate, and there's iron oxide. Not, you know.
Yes.
Thank you for that emphasis. And this is not just elemental iron. We didn't find any evidence of that in the red material. So now we go on to higher magnification, 50,000 power. It's Dr. Fair pushed it up, and this, he's the first to see this. I'm just getting goosebumps here again. I mean, you see these grains. Can you see the extreme right there, the bright spots? And you see them more in the center of the SEM image as well. These are grains, and they happen to be rich in iron and oxygen. And the aluminum is found in these plates. Can you see right near the center below that set of grains, there's aluminum. And then around this, there's this kind of a wavy material. This is an organic matrix rich in carbon. Now, this red material is most interesting to us because it has aluminum inside these plate-like structures. The plate-like structures are quite uniform in thickness from what we can observe with the scanning electron microscope, 50 nanometers wide. Plus, the iron oxide appears in these ultra-fine faceted grains, approximately 100 nanometers across, and again, very uniform. Again, let me emphasize, this is not from the building collapsing with, sure, there's aluminum and iron and titanium and calcium and sulfur and zinc and copper in the building. But that's not what you see here. Here you see uniform, right? Grains. This is engineered material. I just, you know, if you're a scientist, you just can't say, well, randomly, you know, the building falls down and we're going to get a few of these things. No. And we get 9/10 of this stuff. So we extrapolate. So this is not building stuff randomly mixed together. But what can it be? Okay, now we'll discuss the thermitic reaction, which involves aluminum, elemental aluminum, and iron oxide, which are present in the red material. When these are ignited, as I show in this little demonstration, experiment that I did, aluminum powder and iron oxide powder, you get aluminum oxide. Could you see the white plume wisping away above the molten iron? The molten iron is a yellow-white hot coming out of this reaction. It's extremely hot, and you get molten iron. You notice you start out with iron oxide, but you end up with iron. What happened? And you start out with aluminum and end up with aluminum oxide. Can you see what's happening? The aluminum grabs the oxygen from the iron oxide, and you get the end products, aluminum oxide, much of which comes off in this plume. It looks like smoke, except it's white. It's quite bright, and it floats away, fine white plume. And the molten iron then form, reduced iron. We'll see. But I want to just say now, while we're thinking about it, that this red material, when we ignite it, we get iron spheres. Many of these spheres are nearly pure iron. Not enough oxygen in them to be iron oxide, you see. Less than 1:1 even. So we get molten, because it was spheres, now iron, that are formed from the red chips when we just heat them up to about 430 centigrade, as we'll see, they react and release a lot of energy, and then we get molten iron. Folks, this is the signature for a thermitic reaction. And we nailed it. It took a long time to nail it, but we did. We nailed it. One thing I'd like to get perfectly clear, if I can possibly, and I wish there's someone here from NIST who would listen to this. Thermite, I agree, is an incendiary, ordinary thermite, which means powders of aluminum and iron.
You're listening to Taking Aim with
Rob Schoen
and Maya Schoen for our extended 3-hour special during this WBAF fund drive. And we are bringing you today excerpts from two very important DVDs, Nanothermite, an incredible lecture by Stephen Jones, physicist at Brigham Young, a lecturer, a professor for 20 years, and also someone who did nuclear research for the U.S. government, a man who was methodical in his research approach. And he investigated the dust particles, in particular, from the collapse of the 9/11 buildings, and in this speech he goes through step by step what happened with the controlled demolitions, why it was a controlled demolition, and what they discovered was the product that was used to bring the buildings down.
In 90,000 tons of dust, brothers and sisters, the presence of red and gray chips, which emit evidence of
Nanothermite, and they estimate it being over 9 tons. And nanothermite is only available through Department of Defense labs. Now, this is Nanothermite by Stephen Jones, the lecture, and it's for your contribution of $50 to WBAI. And as well, we had 9/11, The Myth and the Reality, the two DVD set of the lecture of theologian David Ray Griffin, and the combination of the two for $125. We are fortunate to have on the line with us Greg Roberts, who's one of the co-authors of the seminal seminal piece that is available on the Internet, published so that everyone in the world can read it and confront the evidence about nanothermites, called Active Thermitic Material Discovered in the Dust from the 9/11 World Trade Center Catastrophe. This is Greg Roberts, who's based in Berkeley, California, and one of the members of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth.
And you heard from Richard Gage earlier, and here is his close working colleague, Greg Roberts. We're very happy to have you with us, Greg.
Thanks,
Greg, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Thanks for having me.
Hi, Greg. You've been working closely with Stephen Jones and Niels Harrit and the other co-authors. Could you tell us something about the evolution of this research and the impact that it's having?
Sure. I've tuned in a bit late. I just heard the last few minutes of Dr. Jones speaking, of course. The motivation to look at the dust was, of course, something that, in retrospect, we wish we'd done a long time ago, but, you know, we can let bygones be bygones. We have what we have now, and it was most directly motivated by the findings reported by a government agency, the USGS, U.S. Geological Survey, the RGA Lee Group, and others who found these strange microspheres of iron left in the dust. They characterized it as iron microspheres, iron-rich microspheres. One of those agencies found it was 150 times, there was 150 times as much iron in the dust from the World Trade Center as ordinary dust, I guess, from that area. And so it was a puzzle for them, and they didn't really go beyond saying something along those lines. They just described it. They didn't ask where it came from, which is kind of interesting.
Were they looking for the environmental impact?
That's right. They were trying to characterize the dust and understand how the dust, inhaling the dust, may have affected people, or even after the cleanup, of course. I'm sure a lot of it ended up in the river and all that, so that was their motivation. But as Dr. Jones has, may have explained already, the spherical shape indicates that the iron was in a molten state when it solidified and was formed into the spheres that we see. It was not produced by some sort of abrasive process, which would have produced either, you know, irregularly shaped crystals or blobs. You know, these are quite spherical, quite uniform, and it's a clear indication that steel liquefying, iron liquefying temperatures were reached during the destruction of the World Trade Center. So the natural question to ask after that is, you know, how could that have happened? What else might there be in the dust that could help us understand this? And so further tests were done over quite a period of time amongst the team, and we certainly thought we were onto something looked at it from many angles. We got extensive peer review comments during the production of the paper, the editing of the paper. And so we came on out with it, and we're still, I'll stop a minute and let you see if you have another question.
No, you're speaking very well about the process, and we have been listening to parts in between the hours of 5 and 6. We also listened to parts, and we've been discussing this, and we discussed it with Richard Gage also. But we'd like to know, what is the impact of the of this paper and the work of Dr. Jones and others about their conclusion that this was nanothermite and this was definitely the material used for control, the systematic control demolition only available through Department of Defense sources?
Yes. Well, the response has been, unfortunately, what one would expect if one has studied the response to other aspects of the 9/11 research done by those of us who noticed a lot of strange statements in the official story, inconsistencies with the laws of physics and with known facts and standard procedures of all kinds. So there were two audiences or two groups of people that we've gotten responses from. The first group is, you know, officials, NIST and people like that, that you would think it's their responsibility to deal with continuing new discoveries about the evidence. Their response has been silence. Essentially, they the frequently asked questions and responses on NIST's website continue to talk about thermite rather than nanothermite and just pretend that there's no distinction or that nothing's been found since they wrote their answer about that. So that's again, disappointing but not a surprise. What can they say, you know, unless they want to say, yeah.
Greg, nanothermite reacts very rapidly, even explosively, as your paper makes clear, and is referred to sometimes as super thermite. And one of the points that is made in the paper is that the observations reminded us of nanothermite fabricated at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory and elsewhere. And available papers describe this material as an intimate mixture of UFG aluminum and iron oxide in nanothermite composites to form pyrotechnics or explosives. Now, these are chemical components that are not present other than in this dust. They are not part of the structure of the building. They are certainly not any part of a primer paint. And consequently, it is clear their very presence points to and after all, the paper well establishes that this is a highly explosive material. It's a material developed in the Department of Defense by the Pentagon. It is in a substantial quantity. Would you address the extraordinary implications of this discovery?
Well, yes, and I guess first to finish the answer to the previous question, but remind me of the one you just said when I get done with that, you know, it's a two-part answer. The officials have not really replied at all. And then the other side of it is people on the Internet who typically attack our motives, attack our intelligence, and they say things like, it's just primer paint, or it was created by the impact of the planes. You know, well, I don't want to stoop to the same tactics they use, but, you know, it's clear that they are not absorbing what we wrote. Let me put it that way. Whether they read it or not, I don't know, but they're not absorbing it. We obviously took into account that it could be paint, and the paper takes care of that possibility in several ways. None of these people have published themselves any sort of peer-reviewed response or letter that we have seen. And this is how science proceeds. When we didn't have a peer-reviewed paper about this stuff, they said, well, there's no reason to pay attention to you since you don't have a peer-reviewed paper. So now that we have one, you know, the ball's in their court, and there's a whole bunch of balls sitting there in their court that they're not hitting back to us. So to get to your question, it certainly provides another avenue for serious investigation since there is, in a sense, a signature to this kind of explosive, just as conventional explosives are given chemical taggants, they call it, tagging agents or identifying agents, so that they can trace explosives that are used in a crime back, you know, who got it, where did they buy it, was it stolen, or did somebody who has legal access to these things, did they sell it to them? And all these questions would have to be, should be investigated. It should be traced back to the labs, you know. And I say, if I think somebody's very skeptical of where we're coming from, I say, look, even if Al-Qaeda did this, we need to know how they did it. This changes everything. They didn't just hijack airliners, right? They hijacked extremely sensitive military-grade explosives that were just developed in the years before 9/11. So, of course, I think in this audience, it's clear that you have to put Al-Qaeda in quotes at best, but the point is, you know, we can go to these national laboratories and we can say, look, let's talk about your security procedures. Let's talk about who you've been talking to that might have an interest in this whole false flag operation, you know.
Right, and what Dr. Jones makes very clear is that you're talking about more than 9 tons, almost 10 tons of explosive that could not have been placed at the time of the construction of the building, since it wasn't developed until 1991, and had to involve the highest levels of security, and probably during the remodeling, the upgrading of the elevators, which gave access to the core of the buildings. In the first part of the lecture, he goes through what is a controlled demolition, and there is much video to describe you know, to show the similarities between the collapse on the footprint of World Trade Center 7 in particular and other controlled demolitions. And then he goes step by step through what took place, and then we going deeper into the story about why it was nanothermite. Dr.
Yes.
Jones himself has done this at great personal risk. First, when he did his first research on 9/11, and he presented it at Brigham Young in a colloquium, and his fellow scientists at Brigham Young University gave him credit for what he was doing. They understood and they acknowledged that there was a reason to it. But the administration of Brigham Young put him on administrative leave and then forced him into early retirement. And it's not because of the quality of his work for 20 years at Brigham Young University. It had to do with researching about 9/11, going against the official fiction. That's what is so important about WBAI, too. It is only here that we can present things that test official fictions. And that's why we need you to call. We're offering this important lecture by Dr. Stephen Jones, Nanothermite, your contribution of $50, and also David Ray Griffin's analysis of what he calls the sacred myths, nine sacred myths about 9/11, and that's a two DVD set for $100. You keep WBAI in the air. These are our gifts to you for your contribution. Together for $125, you can have both lectures and more. There is supplemental material on each of these DVD sets. Please, 212-209-2950. It's only on a program like Taking Aim that we can bring on Greg Roberts, we bring on Richard Gage, we bring on Frank Morales. It's up to you to keep this going. 212-209-2950. There are people in the pledge room. Max Schmidt is there in the engineering booth. He's going to keep us apprised of how we're doing with the phone lines. Please, get on the line now, and we'll return to a little bit more of the nanothermite when we have all those phones lit up. Ralph?
But I want to mention something in particular, because this extraordinarily important paper, Active Thermitic Material Found in WTC Dust, addresses, as nothing else has, the necessary element to account for the collapse of this building in freefall. The three buildings on their footprint. Now, brothers and sisters, this is an extraordinary complex task. Controlled demolition is not something that you do casually. You have to calculate the location and the impact of specific location of explosive implements. You want the thing to fall on its footprint and not to destroy catastrophically, as would in a non-controlled demolition collapse of the WTC towers, the tens of thousands of people in the surrounding area would have been killed and maimed without the controlled demolition collapsing it on its footprint. To do that is not a small matter. It is the most sophisticated kind of technically challenging undertaking and operation. So from the immediate impact of this important research, we understand that the nanothermite, which reacts very rapidly, even explosively, and is referred to as superthermite. The ultrafine grain is intimately mixed, this nanothermite, in the hands of the military. It's not merely that we've identified, or to put it correctly, that Greg Roberts and Stephen Jones and their colleagues have, through this work, identified the element, the explosive element, that brought down the towers, but it addresses the question of the necessity for the highest authority with security access, the military itself, and the location of these explosives in the specific places in the building in order to accomplish this result. Greg, would you address exactly the implications of all of this for understanding the freefall collapse of the building?
Sure. Well, several points I could make. First of all, I want to make clear to people who have serious doubts about these findings, for whatever reason they may have those doubts, we didn't need to find the explosive to know that the towers were demolished, and Building 7, by the way. There's no other way to explain the features of the destruction. This is what people on the blogs and the forums don't understand. They hear the word collapse and they just make up stuff that they think could cause a collapse of some kind. But what we saw was high-speed ejections of massive multi-ton assemblies of steel ripped apart from each other in many cases, but also large pieces stuck together, assemblies flung across the street, instantaneous speeds of 50 to 70 miles an hour of these pieces of steel that weigh more than a fully loaded 18-wheeler. This is, you know, it's because of the effectiveness of the PSYOP, the shock and awe that plunged, you know, it turned off people's prefrontal cortex, literally, and it just left them in this state where they were not rationally thinking. People who should know better have bought this story for this whole time. So we didn't have to find the actual agent that was used, the explosive, I should say, the chemical, to know that it was an explosive controlled demolition. The destruction of all three towers was too rapid, too thorough, too explosive, and too symmetrical to have been the natural result of the impacts by the airplanes and the fires that followed.
That's very elucidating, very, very important, Greg, because of, as you say, I mean, the official fiction about the hydrocarbon fire accounting for the collapse of the building is, of course, without any basis in any...
It defies the laws of physics.
Yes, the laws of physics would have to be reversed on that particular day.
Completely.
But if
there was going to be a collapse at all, the upper sections of the Twin Towers should have fallen off the intact section. You have to engineer something like this for the destruction to go all the way down the building the way that it did. And in Building 7, it's even more obvious. We start with Building 7 at Architects and Engineers when we do our presentations because it's just so undeniable. It has everything in common with a controlled demolition and nothing in common with something that was just random damage, asymmetrical damage cannot give rise to a symmetrical result.
Max, do we have time for another 5 minutes of the nanothermite, and then we'll return?
I suppose we do. Let's go to it.
And again, 212-209-2950, your last opportunity. Please get on the line.
With two callers on the line.
Well, step it up, brothers and sisters. Greg Roberts is laying out for you the most extraordinary implications of this significant work, this extraordinary intellectual gathering of people who are dedicated to understanding the truth and to make it available to the broad public what happened to the World Trade Center towers, the real underlying dynamics of that collapse.
And as what Ralph and I do each and every week, on taking aim with the socioeconomic political analysis in meticulous detail, this is what you have unfolding with Stephen Jones, with the actual physical data of the destruction of the 9/11 towers. Please, 212-209-2950. Take it away, Max.
Explosive. It reacts very fast. The smaller the grains, the faster the reaction. That's been demonstrated in published papers. And we see, for example, this is from a Lawrence Livermore National Lab. Anybody here from Livermore? I welcome you. I'd like to discuss this with you. In fact, we have been in contact with Dr. Tillotson. Dr. Farrer has been in contact with him. Haven't learned too much yet, but they published papers, as we will see. To me, this is quite exciting. In the lower right, you see the explosion of this. It's called nanothermite or superthermite. This is the ultra-fine grain. Okay, now, quick quiz. Superthermite is A, incendiary, or B, explosive? B. Okay, very good. Now, actually, you can tailor nanothermite, which is interesting, so that you can make it react faster, slower, louder. It just has all these variations. You can tailor it. But it can be explosive, is what I'm trying to say here, as you see from the photo from Lawrence Livermore National Lab. I had a BBC crew came through the lab, took photos videos, I mean, of me and I think others in the lab as we worked on these red gray chips. And interestingly, they asked Livermore if they could show this photo, a photo from a published paper, and Livermore declined, would not allow them to show nanothermite exploding. But it does, you see. It's very important. I have here a nail, which is rusty, and a piece of aluminum foil, such as you might find in in buildings. There is rusty iron and there's aluminum. Does this make up thermite that will form an incendiary, for example? The answer is no. I've done experiments with stuff like this. Large chunks of rusty iron or steel combined with large chunks of aluminum do not make for a vigorous reaction as we've seen in thermite. It requires these intimate mixing of smaller particles of aluminum and iron oxide. You can actually get a small spark. I've done that too with this. Just one spark is quite typical. If you hit this hard enough, for example, you can get one spark, but not the vigorous reaction, and certainly not like nanothermite. Okay, let me move on. Here we see some, and I thank Ken Jenkins and Hamouk, Dr. Hamouk, for doing the steadying, the stabilization. You see this photo? I'm sorry, the video of, this is the South Tower, just minutes prior to its collapse. Let's see if we can look at that one more time. In the lower right-hand photo, we see thermite, okay, just so you can compare the colors and so on. Now watch, if you watch here closely, this is stabilized, you know, the person holding it couldn't hold his camera that steady. But if you watch this orange, yellow, oh, see there, the cloud wisp away, the white, it looks just like aluminum oxide. So this is something I've been in discussion with NIST about too, what that can be. And I suggest that could be the product of the thermitic reaction. Okay. Aluminum plus iron oxide and ultrafine, as we have observed now in this red material, what does that imply? We look at a published report. It's available April 2000, so about a year and a half, roughly, before 9/11. Here's what they say. Energetic nanoxoy, that's various ratios of iron and oxygen, and metallic aluminum. So iron oxide and metallic aluminum, elemental aluminum, these can be formed. This is called nanothermite or superthermite. The compositions are stable, safe, and can be readily ignited. I've got the equation at the bottom. That will also be on the quiz. Thank you. Okay, let's carry on. I just think it's so interesting to read these early reports. How do you characterize a nano thermite? Well, they explain. Energetic nanocomposites are a class of material that have both a fuel, aluminum in this case, and oxidizer, iron oxide in this case, component intimately mixed and where at least one of the component phases meets the size definition, which they say is less than 100 nanometers to make the nanothermite. And that is the case for the iron oxide grains, which are just about 100 nanometers and quite uniform. Also, the aluminum that we find in these plates, the plates are about 40 nanometers thick. Here's what I was looking for, this wonderful map. This is in the paper, so you can study it, a little bit of homework on your free time. It's just, again, just so exciting. Dr. Ferrer took these maps, isn't that? Whoa, look at that, you know? So what are we looking at here? Upper left is an image through the electron microscope. You see the bright grains. How do you know they're iron and oxygen? Well, you look at the blue picture. That's for Fe. In other words, we're scanning over, looking for iron, looking for blue. The purple is aluminum. The green is oxygen. The light blue in the lower left corner is silicon, and the red is carbon. So you see where these things lie. And what we see is that we have iron oxide and aluminum, although here you can't tell real clearly whether it's aluminum oxide or not because there's so much silicon associated with the aluminum as this stuff is constructed and engineered. It wasn't until we did the MEK separation that we found the aluminum pulled apart from the silicon oxide and that we're able to nail the presence of metallic aluminum. Again, you can look in the paper. There's another SEM map there. But again, we have this intimate mixing of iron oxide and aluminum and this very tiny grains of this oxidizer. I'll just tell you, it goes back about 10 years before 9/11/2001, certainly long after the buildings were constructed. I get that question. No, it could not have been put into the buildings when they're constructed because it had not been high-tech technology. And here are some of the uses. Livermore report in 2000. Using a fuel metal such as aluminum into the metal oxide silicon oxide matrix, energetic materials based on thermite reactions can be fabricated. I'm not making this up. This is, you know, these national labs explaining this wonderful explosive material. Organic additives, hence the carbon observed, can cause the generation of gas upon ignition of the materials, therefore resulting in a composite material that can perform pressure volume work. Boom. Right? Explosive work. Method, and they describe a method of making nanostructured energetic materials, specifically explosives.
Taking Aim with and Maya Schoen. Tonight we've been bringing you excerpts and discussion about two very important DVDs, Nanothermite, a lecture by Dr. Stephen Jones, 20 years physicist at Brigham Young University, and also 9/11, The Myth and Reality, a lecture by David Ray Griffin, well-known theologian and debunker of the sacred myths, particularly the analysis of the 9/11 Commission report. And in his DVD, he goes through an analysis of what he calls the sacred myths, nine myths. We are now talking with Greg Roberts, who's one of the co-authors of an important peer-reviewed piece by Stephen Jones and other physicists that specifies what was used to bring down the World Trade Center buildings, and that is nanothermite. Greg, in these last moments, we are trying to get people to get on the phone, to get this nanothermite lecture for themselves so that they can not only hear, but they can see the evidence. 212-209-2950. Greg, so now we have Richard Gage going around speaking, and I assume Stephen Jones is doing a lot of lecturing. And people, are they contacting you, and are more physicists saying, yes, Eureka, you have done it?
Unfortunately not. Even when we do outreach, we find that people often express interest cautiously, and then we don't hear from them again.
You've had some 930 or 960 architects and engineers who are now part of our Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. That's an extraordinary accomplishment. A tribute to your work.
Thank you. Yes, in the face of the resistance that people have, both emotionally and practically, in terms of their careers, understanding, with some realism, how their bosses or potential bosses might respond to a Google search on their name when they apply for a job, this is a high number for us to achieve. Our detractors say, "Well, there's millions who haven't signed." It's like, well, most of them haven't even heard of us, thanks to the media, and it doesn't matter. This is what people don't understand about a scientific issue like this, is that the truth is not determined by a majority vote. It is not democratic. It doesn't care whether you understand what's going on or not. And again, before we had this kind of support from people in the field, relevant fields of study, the response from detractors was, well, you don't have anybody who's an expert who agrees with you. that was never true. We had people on the day of, you know, coming out and saying, this doesn't make any sense. You know, those towers were blown up. There were people
Such as ourselves.
Yes, thank you. But as you say, when we get people who are willing to put it on the line and sign their real name and their real city and state of residence or whatever, and you know, call out for a new investigation, petition their government for a redress of grievances. This is, so far, we still have this right to do that without being shot for it or imprisoned. And more and more and more of us need to do this before we lose that right.
Absolutely.
I to put this in context, I want to put in a plug for a book that I just read recently that everybody should read who's listening to this show, whether you agree with us about 9/11 or not. It is called The End of America by Naomi Wolf, and she outlines the steps that fascist states, that police states go through as they close down, starting from a democratic open system, over and over in history. She's gathered the examples, and she sees that our country is going through the same steps, has gone through the same steps. People in power have put in place, they've changed the laws, they've changed the attitudes, and one of the most important things I got from this book is that by obfuscating what's going on, by not responding to rational arguments, one of the things that gets established by the leadership, by the powerful in a police state as it starts to close down more and more, is that it's not just that they deny the truth, it's that they are so cynical and so manipulative, people start to think that there's no way to determine what the truth is.
And that's why, Greg, it is so important that people get on the line. I've heard the phones ringing. We have only 2 or 3 minutes left. 212-209-2950, Nanothermite by Dr. Stephen Jones, an incredible analysis. You will be convinced, but most of all, you will be able to explain to your friends, your family, your neighbors, what really happened. And also 9/11,
that's right,
Myth and Reality, David Ray Griffin debunking what he calls the sacred myths, feeding into what you were saying, Greg, about 9/11. And most of all, people, please tune in to Taking Aim each and every week with our meticulous documentation. We analyze and we create we discuss the way forward. Ralph.
Well, what Greg has been discussing just now is critical. The End of America is about, as we've described it, the architecture of the fascist state. Hand in hand with treason at the top, the attack on the World Trade Center towers, the terrorists, officials who are in charge of government, goes the war against the people of the United States, the war against the truth, the war against our information and our access to the data that shows what is happening in our society. Critical that we fight back, that we arm ourselves with information, that we take advantage of the extraordinary work and contribution of Greg Roberts, of Richard Gage, of Stephen Jones, of David Ray Griffin, Frank Morales, that we arm ourselves with information, with knowledge, so that we're prepared for the necessary struggles ahead, brothers and sisters. Thank you so much, Greg, for being with us. We hope to have you join us again in the near future. We're grateful to you and for the important work you've done in collaboration with Stephen Jones and with Richard Gage. Brothers and sisters, continue to call in for these DVDs. It's part of the furniture of our lives. As Maya said earlier, this is not a spectator sport. This affects us vitally, all of us. We're in it together. Thank you so much, brothers and sisters.
Thanks for having me. Thank you very much, Greg. 212-209-2950. Our gifts to you for your generous contribution to your station, WBAI, the unique station, listener-sponsored, but not only that, the station that takes risks. Risks with the analysis about 9/11. Remember, in the first days after 9/11, it was WBAI that brought on Ralph Schoenman with World Trade Center Uncensored History, unique programming, and it is now WBAI that continues with the analysis, going even deeper to the physical evidence with nanothermite. I was duly impressed, and you know, folks, with all I've seen and read and heard, when I'm impressed, this is something that you will be impressed with, too. Nanothermite, the lecture by Dr. Stephen Jones, so clear in his presentation. you will understand it, particularly with the graphics in his lecture. Nanothermite, $50 contribution. 9/11, The Myth and the Reality, a 2-DVD lecture by David Ray Griffin. Again, very easy to understand. Debunking the Sacred Myth, the 9 myths that he puts forward. And that's $100. And for $125, all these DVDs. Remember, these are our gifts to you for generous participation. Participation in your radio station, WBAI. And the fund drive will continue. Please continue to give generously. And we will return with our regular programming after the fund drive at our regular time slot, 5 to 6 on Tuesdays. Please contact us at Taking Aim at PacBell, that's PACBELL.net. We enjoy hearing from you. And visit our website where we have an archive of almost 8 years of programming, and that's at www.takingaimradio.com.
Thank you, Maya Schoen. Thank you, Ralph Schoenman. And it's 9:01 with four callers on the line, $4,000 in the till, and probably more that hasn't been tallied. We're about to turn it over to Delphine Blue with Shocking Blue. Special fundraising edition coming your way just about now here at WBAI New York.